Hello and welcome back to Hitchcast. Today we have a special episode for you featuring a conversation between my business partner Brett Starr and one of the top leaders in the security space, Keith White, EVP of Gap Inc. In this episode, Keith shares insights of his unique professional journey and the many obstacles he's encountered along the way. Keith also details his passion and special relationship within the larger community as a top-tier, underrepresented security leader. This is a longer recording, and we appreciate you sticking around through the full episode as Keith is a true treasure to our community. Please enjoy.
Keith, I wanted to have this talk because there was a lot of things when we had the opportunity to meet with you that I wanted a wider audience to learn about in terms of your background and what's made you successful. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to kind of share some of your best practices throughout your journey and your career. If you could, can you give us an overview of your career? Tell us what you do, and walk us through the story.
Okay, I always like to start with the beginning. I'm what I call a first generation security executive, coming out of college with an undergrad degree in law enforcement administration. I thought for sure I would work in law enforcement at one of the agencies. There was just a number of things that I was pursuing. And as fate would have it, while doing an internship, a friend of mine called me up and said, "Hey, Keith, there's this job in loss prevention that they wanted me to interview for, but I already have one. I gave them your name. Is that okay? Are you interested? And by the way, you know, it's a paying internship that may lead to an opportunity." The part paying really caught my ear because at the time I was working a midnight shift for money. The internship I was working was not paying at Burger King. And so I said, "Sure, sign me up. I'm in." By the way, what's loss prevention? Had no idea what it was. But I was willing to try anything. And as soon as I went on the interview, and shortly after getting the job offering, getting hired, I learned very quickly, Brett, that this was the career path that I never knew about, that was always for me. It was kind of weird. It was something I didn't know about, but it was built perfectly for me because it allowed me to work in a capacity where I was able to pursue the bad guy, if you will, work in investigations, all the things that I had been trained for in my academic studies. But at the same time, there was this really appealing crossover effect. Like I could lead teams, manage budgets, establish a strategy. I mean, things that, you know, the business side of me that always screamed for. So you had that intersection of the two, and I took it and ran with it. I started off as a supervisor of a contract guard force in this distribution center on the south side of Chicago, and very quickly elevated in that company and ultimately made my way to Target and made my way up to regional manager and then director. And then, of course, I spent the last 20 years at Gap overseeing not just loss prevention, actually broadened my leadership repertoire, where I was able to manage corporate administration, which included facilities, corporate real estate, events, travel, a number of other areas that had a very close nexus to the corporate security world, but were different in their own right. And then ultimately, culminating in managing and leading global sustainability around the world for Gap Inc., which was magnificent. So I've had an unbelievable career thus far. And, I'm really excited to share that story with others because I think, a lot of people out there in our field aren't thinking big enough. They're kind of tunnel vision. They're great subject matter experts. They're not sure what's next and they're doing terrific jobs. But I think there's a lot of potential for them to play up, to play broader, and to play bigger. So,
and Keith, you spent about 20 years at Gap, which is inordinate amount of time at one company. But the reality is, you didn't just do the same job while you were there. And I think it would be interesting to kind of share the progression of roles that you've had and how you've used your experience to kind of build upon and get to the next level.
Well, you know, that's really, I think how and why you have me here, Brett. You know, starting my professional career at Gap 20 years ago was absolutely amazing. I came in to manage and lead their loss prevention program, which was growing and developing into something special. And I had a chance to, you know, really put my fingerprint on that, which I thought was great. But what I didn't realize is that there would be growth opportunities that would allow me to take on responsibilities that were not in that traditional frame of duties. And as I mentioned earlier, with corporate administration, I'll never forget, my boss sat me down one day and she said, you know, Keith, there's so much more you could do here. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm sure I can. And she said, no, you don't understand. I actually think you could expand your responsibilities in a much more of a general manager sense. And that's what led to the responsibilities related to corporate administration, which I just, you know, really sunk my teeth into and I thought was fantastic because it gave me an opportunity to work another skill set of leadership. Also, you know, that ultimately allowed me to work in areas like business continuity planning and really own it for the entire corporation, not just disaster recovery or crisis management, but really sitting down with IT and talking about recovery time objectives and failovers and hot sinks. And, you know, if something were to happen with the corporation, how resilient are we? So that's what I mean by saying it wasn't a traditional career path. There were other opportunities afforded to me, which I just jumped on.
And when you look at that progression, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of same thing happened in my career where opportunities just kind of presented themselves. You didn't even think that they were possible. And you take a look at the data and say, hey, that looks like a really interesting deal. I'm going to, you know, give it a try. And then, you know, it's a little bit of a risk. But, you know, if you don't take those risks, as we know, you don't kind of reap the rewards at the other end. What were some of the risks and progressions that you went through at Gap? You know, some of the additional responsibilities that you took on that at first glance probably looked like a little bit of a risk, but then turned out to kind of really add to your leadership capabilities.
You know, that's a great question because I'm so glad you asked it that way. Because the audience may be thinking, oh, sure, yeah, you know, sign you up for more responsibility and it all works out and, you know, you just grow into it. It just doesn't work that way. There is risk. And there's a fear of failure. And I would say, you know, one of the biggest challenges I face, and I guess the best example is corporate real estate and facilities. And I'm not mocking the area, but literally, you know, up until owning that area, I just thought the building opened every morning on time. You pulled into the parking lot and you rode the elevator up to your office. And that was the end of the story. You know, I really didn't know or think about anything further than that, not realizing that there's a cost per square feet, that they're managing a certain level of occupancy, that there's a master plan for growth of the company. You know, will you need more facilities? And then at what year will you bring them online? I mean, we had master plans that spanned 20 years. We had leases on some of our buildings that went 20 years. And I'm talking millions and millions of dollars of commitment and strategic puts and takes that you would have to go back and forth with the CEO and the CFO on and make sure that they were on board and they had confidence in your plan. And then here you are sitting there, you know, planning it out. And, you know, for someone like myself, you could argue with limited experience in that area. So the fear of failure, especially when you get into territory that you're not as comfortable with, that you don't have the expertise that you had in the corporate security world, you start to kind of wonder, and the imposter syndrome, you know, kind of creeps in. You start to kind of second guess whether or not you should have grown laterally as you thought you could. And what was comforting for me in this whole process was the fact that every time I've come up against an obstacle or things I didn't know, I've always found myself extremely resourceful. And I've always been able to plug into a great network of resources. And what I found is that that principles, those two items for me transcended having additional responsibility. So as long as I was resourceful and I had a network when I got into corporate real estate and I was willing to learn and absorb and say I didn't know when I didn't know, I ultimately found a path that got me to a level of competency where I was able to manage that function and manage it well. But there was fear because, like as I said earlier, you start to get into some pretty high risk decisions that could ultimately cost the company a great deal of money and you, your reputation, and maybe in some cases your longevity with the company.
You have this massive purview of responsibility at Gap. And people should understand, walk us through ultimately what you were responsible for at the company. I mean, Gap is over, what, $14 billion in revenue, 130,000 employees, 3,600 stores. Walk us through kind of the area of responsibility that you have, your team, what are the functions that you own, what are kind of some of the major responsibilities that you have?
Sure. I will start with loss prevention itself. And you said it well, you know, almost $16 billion in revenue, over 3,000 stores doing business in about 50 different countries, and roughly almost 1,000 team members reporting up under me with a pretty significant management structure to support them that included vice presidents and senior directors and directors. So just on the loss prevention side, you had a team managing that field organization, you know, where you have millions of customers who are coming in and out of stores, and they are apprehending and dealing with thousands of shoplifters and theft instances a day. We also had specialized teams that worked on organized retail crime and people who were targeting us in a very organized criminal enterprise way. We had a supply chain team that worked on all of the issues supporting our fulfillment centers around the globe and the theft and the fraud that can occur there. We had a cybersecurity team that worked with our InfoSec world on their physical security needs that could relate to cybersecurity as well as the awareness security needs. So that team alone, I would say, Brett, was, pretty expansive and, was responsible for a number of things. From a global sustainability perspective, you look at a world that gets even bigger because you're talking about 800 factories and 200 mills around the world and over a million factory workers that Gap was indirectly responsible for managing, leading, and ensuring that how they worked and how they were supported was done in a very ethical, responsible manner. Plus, you know, our carbon footprint, our use of cotton in a responsible way, and all the other things that go with it. So I had a team of folks on that. And then, of course, I've talked probably enough about the corporate administration responsibilities. So there was a lot going on. It was a budget that exceeded $100 million, and a lot of responsibility and coordination. And I just have to say, I enjoyed every minute of it. Just, you know, the challenges, the problems, the things that you have to overcome, the things that you have to keep in focus, challenging business partners, internal and external, you know, different types of crisis that would come up, everything from, you know, earthquakes to fires to hurricanes to tsunamis. My team was involved in, and it was very, very challenging, but that rewarding awesome. At the same time.
And you were basically in this really large role for quite a while. What are the key tools in your tool belt, if you will, that allow you to do this job in the manner that you do it?
You know, a colleague of mine early on in my career, when I first became director or VP, said to me, shared an article with me that said, you know, most VPs and directors last maybe 3.5-5 years max. You know, that's your runway at a company. And I remember saying, you got to be kidding me. That doesn't sound reasonable. And then when I started to look around and do my own informal survey and really try to understand what was happening, I realized that was actually pretty accurate, that a lot of times your tenure with these companies in these types of roles can be limited to 5 years. And then anything after five is considered, you know, rare or unusual. And I just have to say, from my perspective, what I tried to do every year, I didn't wait for the third year, I didn't wait for the fifth year, is to reinvent myself, to reinvent my team, to stay very closely associated with the trends that was happening in the business, that was happening in the marketplace. We made adjustments all the time. And I think my team would call them, they would say that we evolved, you know. So it wasn't like change for change sake or change because the environment was changing. But there was change and there was evolution because we really wanted to put ourselves in a position to leverage our resources to the best of their ability and to show a top return on those resources for the company. And that became very obvious, I think, to the senior leadership. Like they could actually, I remember one year, this is one of the best examples I could give you. The CEO of one of the brands called me up and he said, hey, I got some extra capital this year and I don't want to see it go to waste. And I know if I gave you guys this capital, you're the only entity in the company that I'm guaranteed to get a payback on. And so he gave us, you know, several million dollars that he was going to use for another project, but couldn't get the project on track that year. And the year was running out. And rather than, you know, let the capital, you know, sit there, he felt like we were a high return investment vehicle. And we showed the return for it, too. But we garnered that kind of a reputation for not just being great at service, great at protection, but there was a return, a really good return on the investment. And what that gave us, Brett, is not only did we earn the right to reinvent ourselves and to evolve, to experiment with things. I mean, we were experimenting with facial recognition you know, 10, 12 years ago, because we could. And we deemed then not ready, you know. But we garnered enough support and a license, if you will, to get out on the vanguard and try things that worked and some things that didn't, because we had a reputation for a pretty high return on the investment. And so for me, if you link that with, you know, being a heads up leader, a great partner, and someone who stayed close to the business trends, it was a combination for longevity that I didn't realize that was the formula, you know. And right now I feel like that's the formula. And I always tell my colleagues, if you're only doing one thing, like if you're only focused on one area and that's your area of expertise, you may get left behind because companies are looking for you to, you know, be able to grow and adjust and contribute in additional ways.
Keith, what role have mentors played in your career progression?
Wow. You know, I've been so blessed with so many mentors over the years. I've had, and here's the thing about mentorship. It's kind of like, you know, when you're in high school or college, you know, and you're on the dating scene, and I don't know if it's true for you, Brett, it probably is, but I wasn't in the long-term game when I was dating. You know, it's like I wasn't sure, you know, what was going to happen, so I kept my options open. And I think that would be, for me, that was my approach to mentorship. I had mentors who taught me things for 2 weeks, and I had mentors that have been with me for the whole 20-plus year ride. And I've always kept my options open because I never knew who would provide that source of wisdom or guidance and where it was coming from. And I mean that from a diversity perspective as well, because typically people only want to be mentored by folks who look like them, who've had the same life experiences, et cetera. And nothing wrong with that. But for me, a lot of the real learning has come from people who look nothing like me, couldn't describe the South Side of Chicago if their life depended on it. But man, what they had to offer was absolutely astounding in terms of what they taught me. So mentorship has been very valuable for me. And I've exploited it fully because I haven't held out for that long term. It must be an awesome match before I allow this person to mentor me. I've basically gone with whoever I could go with and what I could learn from them. And it was a mutual thing. And if it was, like I said, 5 days or 5 years, I was okay with it. And I mentor a lot of people today that way. Some people I've mentored for years and continue to, and others I've said at the end of a year or end of 6 months, there's nothing more that I could share with you. It's time for you to move on, and we can remain friends or what have you, but I want you to use this time valuable. So I've had a different kind of approach to mentoring.
I think that's a great approach to mentorship. I would never look at a mentor personally as, well, I have to follow the whole picture, right? There's various bits and pieces of mentors that I've learned various things from. Some mentors I have are, you know, they help you with financial advice. Some mentors help you with leadership. Some mentors help you with, you know, career counseling, you know, those type of things. So, I mean, I agree with your approach that I don't think you should be so narrow in terms of, you know, of picking a mentor and then having them have to have all those criteria, you know, look like you, follow the exact career path and mm-hmm. what have you. One of the things that strikes me about meeting you and getting to know you is you're off the charts in terms of EQ. Absolutely off the charts. Mm-hmm. And we had talked about this before. This is really no accident. This doesn't just happen because you're who you are. this is purposeful, and I'd love to learn kind of your approach and your philosophy around this.
Thank you for that compliment. You know, years ago, and back when it wasn't even as trendy as it is now, a leader of mine in a one-on-one session sat me down and handed me a book on emotional intelligence. And she said, you know, Keith, you are really progressing nicely. You have a lot of good things about you, but I want you to understand this concept of leadership much better, and I want you to embrace it. And I read the book, and the beautiful thing about emotional intelligence is, unlike IQ, you can improve it, you can develop it, you can grow it, you can build this muscle the rest of your career. And so I sought out to understand more about it, you know, how I came off socially, how I read situations, how I relayed to people, whether or not I was in tune with how well I was connecting with my audience, with my team. And I set out to really build that muscle and that skill set because I saw the advantages it gave me in the workplace, as well as my personal life. And I'm sure you've been in situations in meetings or what have you, where people start to talk or they're saying something and you're like, oh my gosh, they have no clue that the audience is just cringed. Or, oh my gosh, this is not the right time to bring that up. Didn't they just hear what was on the agenda previously around budget? And it's almost like they're tone deaf, or they have a script and they're going to execute the script no matter what. And as a result, they take on probably more of a challenge to get their point across or to get whatever they're trying to sell across because they lost credibility with their audience or they disconnected from their audience because they weren't able to read them or they weren't clear about how they were coming off at the moment. No one, you know, gave them that insight. So it, for me, it is absolutely crucial. If you are going to call yourself a leader, you want to be a leader in this space, to understand and to embrace all that comes with developing the skill set around emotional intelligence. For me, it is, I used to call it the secret sauce, you know, like, okay, if you have that, it really gets you going further. Now, I don't think it's a secret anymore, and I don't think it's a sauce. I would argue it's the main ingredient. And I've seen people who have intelligence off the scale. Yale graduates, Harvard graduates, you name it, have an IQ that just busts through the ceiling. But because their EQ was so low and they had brilliant ideas, nobody wanted to listen to them. Nobody would spend, you know, enough time with them for them to be able to, you know, relay what they wanted to do, or their communication styles or their ability to read social situations or what have you was so poor that they never even got to the idea, you know. So I would argue now, as I started to say, it's the main ingredient. And you could say that it's on par with IQ. In other words, one without the other just does not work, especially if you have very low EQ.
Part of your role as being the head of, you know, physical security and other areas of the organization is to be an influencer. And part of that is with EQ. But how do you kind of package all that up in order to influence other organizations where you don't own the resources?
Being an influencer, and you've seen this happen, I'm sure everyone in this audience has seen this happen. The receptionist the executive assistant, the cafeteria worker, has more influence than some senior level executives in the building. And you're like, oh my gosh, you know, because they'll say something to the right person and all of a sudden change happens. And what people miss in that is that they've developed a certain amount of credibility through their transparency, their honesty, their competency. They may have a little bit of a background in this or a background in that, that forces people to pay attention to what they say. And it didn't happen overnight. I'm sure they didn't walk in the building and was able to do that. But imagine having that a level of influence when you're not a senior level executive. And the goal for me has always been to gain that level of influence and at the same time grow to be a senior level executive, because the two, when you put the two together, they're an awesome combination. And the answer to your question is that you build it, you know, one example, one relationship, one confirmation, one to do. I said I was going to do it. I did it at a time. And over time, people start to respect and value what they see you do. A friend of mine calls it the say-do ratio, that, you know, you pretty much are one-to-one in what you say and what you do. And once people have confidence that you're a real stand-up person and you do what you say you do, you deliver, you follow through, you follow up, when you have an opinion on something, they're more likely to listen. And if your opinion turns out to be right, the next time you have an opinion on something, they're beyond listening. They're ready to do it. And you get one, you get two, you get five, you get eight, you get 100. And all of a sudden, your sphere of influence is phenomenal. But it started with one item, one person, and one thing that you committed to doing, and you did it. And we also know that people are on the opposite side of that, where they don't do anything that they say, let alone show up for the meeting on time. They don't follow up. They don't call you back. They don't answer their emails. They don't answer their texts. They always seem to be absent. And then in the meeting, they have the biggest idea and biggest plan you've ever seen, and they want to roll it out, and they want everybody to buy into it. And people are like, dude, you didn't even bring in the donuts this morning, like you said. You know, how are we going to execute this, you know? And it cuts the other way, and they'll be clueless about it, absolutely clueless about it. So this influencer thing, and I know it's a hot word right now, it's always been around. It's just now it's called influencer in quotes. But what people miss about it is that it's absolutely earned. Nobody gives you a hall pass on that. Never, ever. You absolutely have to earn it, and it's by completing acts of trust. Small ones lead to big ones, and big ones lead to, okay, you can change the game now, you know. So
I suppose a lot of executives come in and think, well, everybody's just going to do what I tell them to do because, well, it's me, without having to earn it.
That's right.
So I think the first part of what you're saying is you got to realize, no, this is going to take time to kind of earn this level of influence, and comes with a series of many deliveries. Gotcha.
Yes.
Let's talk about something that you said you're not willing to compromise on, and that's hiring a great team.
Yes. You know, I forget which author said this. It might have been Malcolm Gladwell. But a big part of leadership is getting the right people on the bus. And once you get them on the bus, together, you can kind of determine where the bus is going to go, how fast it's going to go, which route it's going to take, et cetera. And if you were to meet some of the people who work for me, they are not only the right people on the bus, at any point in time, any of them could drive the bus, you know, they could repair the bus. I mean, they just really know what's going on. And so a big part of my job as a hirer is screening for people who are not only A players, but they see the world you know, differently. It's not about them. They understand the concept of team. They understand the concept of hard work. They understand the concept of, you know, having a high emotional intelligence. They get the whole picture. And I screen for that. As a matter of fact, I just want to quote or reference a book that I love. It's called The Ideal Team Player, and it's written by Patrick Lencioni. You know, many may know him better for writing The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. I mean, he's just been an awesome author. And he talks about ways to recognize and cultivate three essential virtues. And the three virtues, very simply, are humble, hungry, and smart. Humble, humility, they'll put the organization before what they themselves need or want. They get a plan for the whole team. Hungry, they work hard as heck. They are super hard workers. You don't have to worry about that. They're going to put out. And smart, but not intellectually smart, but the EQ part. They have a really high index when it comes to emotional intelligence. And he says, and I live by that, if you find someone who can put all three of those together, you got the winning formula. And that's what I typically have worked on as I've hired and promoted people.
Absolutely
throughout
love
my
it.
Career.
And I mean, are there any tips? How do you screen for that during an interview process? You know, what has been some of those, your best hires, you know, through that?
Well, it's going to sound a little cliche, but rather than focusing on what people have accomplished, because these are very accomplished people, you learn so much more by having them tell you about what they failed at and how they bounce back from that. And to me, there's always greater learnings from failures than successes. Always, always. And how people have been able to pick themselves up and kind of brush themselves off and say, okay, I'm going to go back to the, I'm going to try this again, or I'm going to try something else, or I'm going to try it for the 18th time and see if I can get through, tells you a lot about their character, their stick-to-itiveness, their intestinal fortitude, their drive, their self-motivation. And as I measure those things, if I get a good reading on how well they handle failures, I don't have to worry about successes. I mean, I know they'll have success and I know they'll nail that. But more importantly, I know that they've been in a world and they've operated very well in a world where you have failures from time to time. And super important, to be around people who are comfortable with failure, and smart about how to navigate through that. Because for me, my experience has been those are the people who ultimately figure out how to have success and wow success. I mean, like, they kill it. Not so much the people who, for the most part, have only had success, because if that's all they've had for the most part, failure is going to rock their boat. It's going to really set them back. So that's part of my assessment process.
And that's funny to hear you say that, because I remember, you know, one of the things that I asked you when I met you is, oh, tell me about a mishire. And I don't even think I finished the sentence and you were just laughing. Oh, let me tell you about person X, Y, and Z. Let's go through it one at a time. How open and honest you right. were about it. But there were lessons learned with each of those. And that's kind of the mark of a successful leader. Once you make those kind of rock star hires, what's your approach for training, development, measuring success, and kind of driving the culture that you want driven throughout your team?
Okay. No. Great question. There's a method that I use that I learned from a leader by the name of Stephen Sample. And he's actually written a book called The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. And one of his chapters is called Work for Those Who Work for You. And in this chapter, he opens up by saying you should spend 10% of your time on hiring, evaluating your team, kicking their butt, you know, setting strategy or what have you. And then he said the other 90% you should spend on making them as successful as possible. Like 90% of your time is all about their success, right? You know, and if you followed me around, you know, when I work for, work with my team, but I work for them, I'm early to meetings with my direct reports. I'm taking copious notes. I'm following up on to-dos that they generate. You know, you would like, whoa, who's the boss here? You know, but I'm really serious about that because I believe in a servant model of leadership. But just as important, if I'm really focused on making them successful, there are things that you do, you know, and I'm asking that question. I'm going, hey, what's my role in this initiative or this problem or this challenge? How do you need me to show up? What do you need me to do? And 85% of the time, the answer is probably, no, I got this. But in that 15%, when they need me to do something, it's crucial to their success. And I think a lot of leaders miss that. You know, they think, I gave you the assignment, you make it happen, you know, keep me updated, let me know if you're having problems. But they don't really mean that. And I'm sure you've worked for folks like that. They don't want to hear about the problems. They only want to hear about the successes. And it's a different kind of leader where you feel like they're as invested in you and they're as invested in what you're doing as you are. I mean, that's empowering on its own. And that's been my approach to leadership. And it's you know, for people who haven't worked for me before, it's kind of weird. And for people who get used to it, I think they ultimately learn to really value it. It's kind of a special way of awesome. Operating with your team.
Let's talk about a couple of kind of industry specific items that I wanted to cover with you. When you typically meet somebody in your position, they come from 20 years of three-letter agency backgrounds. They've transitioned to large companies and whatever, and your route is completely different. Okay, and one of the concerns companies may have is, well, hey, Keith White didn't come from one of these agencies, so how is he going to build relationships with those folks in order to get the job done? And how is he going to understand, how to utilize and take the data from those agencies to be effective in my organization? This is something, again, that struck me about meeting you, and that how you've been able to overcome that. I'd just like you to talk a little bit about your approach and how that specific, hole in your background, so to speak, you've been able to deal with that.
Well, you know, first of all, I think I need to say for my colleagues who do have some form of agency or law enforcement service in their background, mm-hmm. I applaud them and love Absolutely. Them alongside them. But at the same time, you're absolutely right in calling that out, because when I started in the industry, and it's still true to a degree today, the senior level positions typically were held by folks who had some type of agency three-letter experience in their background. And for me, you could look at it two ways. You could say, okay, that looks like I'm going to be capped here. That's my ceiling. Or you could find out, and for me, this was very true, you know, what differentiates you and your background and your experience that would allow you to be just as qualified, if not more so, for these senior level roles in the security industry. And the differentiator for me was the fact that I really spent time, as I grew in the corporate security world, understanding the business and developing business acumen that was second to none, understanding customers, understanding leadership models, understanding, obviously, emotional intelligence. And I felt like whatever I didn't have on the law enforcement side, I more than made up for on the business side. And I always projected myself as someone who just happened to be head of the global security operation, but they were first and foremost a senior member of management and leadership. So if you looked at me, you thought I was part of senior leadership, and then you'd have to kind of double check and say, well, but what area does he own again? You know? He owns primarily the corporate security piece. That was significant. The other piece that I did, and I thought I did very well, is that I built incredible relationships, working relationships with law enforcement around the globe that was second to none. In some cases, my team would come in and do training classes on organized retail crime for the FBI or what have you. I mean, we developed an expertise that was attractive to them so that the relationship was much more on even keel. So much so that in some instances they wanted to work for us. You know, we could recruit those team members as well. So I think, you know, as you think about the question and the challenges some of us may face as first generation security executives, it's all about what you've decided would be your strength and what's carried you in this career path thus far. And that's really what you market. And I think if you market that well, you'll be just fine. And you'll be very competitive with anyone who's pursuing, you know, some of these top level jobs that are out there.
Tell us about the role of data in and predictive analytics in your organization. And what that role, you know, data is going to mean to your field moving forward?
Well, data has always meant something, and I feel we just didn't know, you know, how to use it from a proactive sense. And I would say over the last 10 plus years, predictive analytics has become the hallmark of a lot of security and loss prevention and asset protection organizations, because your ability to predict and single out crime patterns, potential incidents, identify risk scenarios or risk levels that may exist out there in stores or facilities or what have you, is an absolute unlock to the business. As a matter of fact, we got so good at predictive analytics, a lot of our tools were used to engage whether or not we should enter certain foreign markets and open up stores. And for me, that was just the ultimate compliment, where, you know, we would sit down with executives leading opening up, you know, new businesses in foreign countries, and they want to know what our analytics told them. And our analytics were so strong, there were times when they would reconsider whether or not we should go into a certain market because the risk level was so high. So we've turned the ability to use analytics into an unbelievable business tool, not just a security tool. And I think that's really the selling point, Brett. When your tools become ubiquitous, You may have created them initially for your own purposes and your own uses, but when other parts of the business are able to experience and benefit from the tools that you've created, you're onto something. And that's what I think the analytics have become. I mean, many of us remember creating crime maps and, you know, predictive modeling, you know, way back when, but they were in on the walls, not on a computer. They were on the walls of our departments, and we would look at them, and we had red and green dots all over the place. And, you know, we weren't sharing them with anybody. This is what we use for ourselves. Now, this modeling that we use can do everything from, you know, identify traffic patterns and heat maps in stores, customer behavior or shopping patterns. And now, you know, with COVID-19, you know, we have iPads taking temperatures of employees coming into our headquarters. I mean, we've really amped it up. And I think it's becoming predictive analytics and the whole data science piece is becoming the bedrock of corporate security because it's just an incredible base to drive business.
I wanted to kind of parlay that into presenting to the board. I know you present to the board at least quarterly, if not more, especially during the current crisis. Is the data piece a big part of that? And, you know, what is your overall approach to presenting to the board?
Well, of course, the board is very much interested in the data piece. And yes, it's a big part of it. But I also have to say, Brett, and this has been true throughout my career, is that, and I think many audience can identify with this, there's data, which is the science, and then there's art, which is, you know, some intuition, some experience, some judgment, some context, and the two absolutely have to go together. They have to go together. And I've done, I think, a really good job of integrating the two, where you can tell the story that the facts say or indicate, but you can also give the context that the facts lie in so that you're making a decision that's three-dimensional. You know, you're also giving employee sentiment. You're giving leading indicators. You're giving, potential concerns that may not have manifested themselves. You're laying out a context where the decision making, in my opinion, is about as effective as it can be. I think if you just went with predictive analytics, it's kind of like, you know, the GPS system on your car. There are times when it tells you to take a right turn and you're like, there's no right turn here. What are you talking about? I'm looking, you know, I'll be going into the side of a mountain or something. And pretty soon it auto corrects itself and you're like, okay, yeah, now you mean for me to take this right turn. Because you have experience, you can see with your own eyes, you know what's going on. And I think data by itself can be a little dangerous, but data with context and with a lot of cover and explanations gets the business to a place where they have the best chance at making the best possible.
A lot of your colleagues that are listening to this will at some point be presenting to the board for the first time. What advice would you give them in terms of preparing those initial presentations to the board?
You know, I'm going to give advice that I received from a former boss of mine. The temptation from board members typically Many of them are sharpshooters. They spent time on somebody's roof being snipers, and they're ready to take you out. You know, I'm being a little facetious, but they really like to get the Q&A immediately. I mean, you know, they've read the deck, they got the pre-read, they just want to fire. And the advice I would give to people who are presenting the boards is get your story out first. Give the context, give the data, you know, whether it's 5 or 15 minutes, work hard to kind of get your story out there, because what you'll see is that it'll take the edge off the questions. And the questions will be more about your data set and the context that you've provided. Because remember, reading a deck is never enough, never enough, without someone giving you some context as to why you put certain things there and why you put them in the way you put them there. And what I found is that when you don't get your story off first, and you can't get laid context for what you're going to, the questions you're ultimately going to answer, you can get shot at or challenged at from so many different ways that all you're doing is answering questions and no one ever gets the context or the overarching mission or strategy. So time will be up because, you know, boards times are very sensitive. And you'll walk out of the room and you'll go, gosh, man, I didn't tell them that. We were really working on this and we ordered the PPE and we're all set for the second wave. They just think, you know, we're surviving right now, you know, and that's why I say it's important to work on getting your story out.
Keith, one of the things that really strikes me about your career is the amount of time you spend heavily involved in community service. There, if you just Google Keith White, you'll see a laundry list of organizations that you've participated in heavily. Talk to us about what role community service plays in your life, in your career, and what are some of the projects and programs that you're proud of?
Wow. You know, it's just not my career. I've been really insistent that my team, the teams that have worked for me over the years, deck a certain amount of time in community service. And I've been fortunate enough to work for Gap, where they give you, you know, 5 hours a month or more to work on various community service projects. And what I've found is that in the world of security, so many of your interactions, your team's interactions, can be negative based, that the offsetting factor and the thing that provides, you know, great context and ultimately compassion to deliver service and to protect people is making sure that they are in tune or locked into giving back or having experiences where they're helping others who aren't necessarily able to help themselves, or they're making a difference in the community in one way or another, something that they can influence and can control, and it's not necessarily just always happening to them. In other words, if you have, you know, some of your inner city team members, you know, supporting a food line or a homeless shelter or what have you, when they have to deal with some of the people who may frequent the stores and shoplift, they have a completely different perspective on them, and they're less likely to judge. And they're more likely to handle it in a very professional, compassionate manner. That's one example, but I think they all link up that way, Brett. And so in my personal life, you know, I volunteer. As a matter of fact, after, you know, we talk, I got a meeting with the Red Cross. The East Bay Parks Foundation. I sit on their board. My wife and I right now are involved in a blood drive for the Red Cross, targeting African Americans because we need blood for sickle cell anemia. I also participate. I'm a board member of an organization called Year Up, which works with inner city youth and placing them at high tech companies. Of course, I volunteer at my church. and a number of other things. But it's been a way of life for me, and wouldn't have it any other way. There's so much going on in this world that consumes your time, you know, from a corporate perspective, that you have to, and it has to be intentional. It's not going to happen if you use the extra time you have. You have to plan this. You have to intentionally plan your time to give back and to help others. And when you do, and when it happens, it is such a relief and such a feeling of balance that it's amazing. So I highly recommend it.
And I would definitely like to wrap up the discussion to talk about, you know, some current event items. In particular, an issue near and dear to our heart is the lack of diversity in security leadership currently. And if you look at across our database, less than 10% of the people come from underrepresented categories. How do you deal with that? How do you drive more diversity and inclusion, you know, within your organization and within the industry?
You know, Brett, this is a topic near and dear to my heart, you know, being a leader of color and really in the industry being a lightning rod for diversity, inclusion, equality, and belonging. It's not something that I chose, but I'm glad, you know, people have found me to be helpful in this area. First of all, the security industry is very misleading. I bet if you just ran the numbers flat out and just said, hey, what's the diversity representation in security? You probably find that minorities are overrepresented in security because a vast majority of them have the hourly positions. So if you just ran the gross number, oh, wait a minute, we don't really have that much of a diversity problem. But if you look at the senior leadership levels and the pipelines that lead to them, there's hardly any diversity at all. And it's, as you depicted, it's less than 10%. And I think as leaders, we all have a responsibility to work towards a world and a climate and a culture that not only embraces diversity, but that creates paths for everyone to obtain any position he or she are interested in or qualified for, and certainly you know, those who deserve them. And I think it's not going to happen. You know, the approach I've taken is establishing a diversity council at my company within loss prevention. And we have worked really hard at making sure that every function and facet was represented on that diversity council. And we've had executive leadership sponsors rotate leading that council to over-index on, you know, driving the message and the culture and the representation issues home, so that we could be the organization we aspire to be. And that was one where equality and belonging, you know, were very apparent, not only in the way we managed and we led, but also visibly. You could actually see it. And that's an ongoing work. It's something that we're very focused on. But if I was advising leaders in this audience, I would say it's incumbent upon each and every one of you not to just say, yes, I believe in diversity and equality. It's a good thing. It's incumbent upon you to be intentional with your actions, in your words and your deeds in this area. There are people on your team who are counting on you to say the right thing, to model the right behavior, to highlight good and bad things that happen that illustrate your commitment. It cannot happen by osmosis, and it certainly cannot happen by you standing there just saying that you support equality and belonging and never really taking any actions that anyone could describe or appreciate to be substantial. So intentionality is a big part of it. You know, over-indexing and working very closely with those on your team who are diverse and those who aren't, and making sure that your actions and your steps and your goaling process is connected throughout the organization so that you do have a clear pipeline, you do have a great culture, and you are representing, you know, what you are preaching. Because I don't think there's anybody out there who's saying, oh, I'm against diversity, I don't really support all of that. I think everybody's saying that they are supportive of it and that they believe in it. The difference is that that's all they're doing. They're just saying it. They're not taking any action, and they're not intentional about it, and they're not, you know, almost a bit of an activist in this area. And that's really what it takes, Brett. It takes an effort. It takes a focus. It takes an extra push or call out or challenge or what have you. And it's not something that you can turn on and off. I know from my work in diversity and inclusion, you know, I've had to call people out who were friends and relatives of mine to say, hey, do not send me this joke. Do not, you know, say these things around me. And if you feel like you have to, then I don't need you around me, or I don't need you communicating to me, or I don't need you to be part of my Facebook or what have you. I mean, I'm like zero tolerance 24/7. I'm not zero tolerance when I'm just at work, you know, and that's what it takes. So,
Keith, I hate that we have to wrap up this discussion. There's so much more to talk about, but hopefully you'll agree to continue this discussion in a podcast coming soon.
Sure, if people want to hear more. Yeah,
we really appreciate it. We've had a blast talking with you, Keith.
Oh, my pleasure. And thanks for the invite. Awesome. Really appreciate this.